found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Thank you, Linda O'Brien. Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and thank you for tuning in to the Maria Sanchez Show, heard live every weekday morning on LATalkRadio.com. And then on demand via downloading the podcast at MariaSanchezShow.com, which is linked to GoDaddy, and they're having problems. And so the website has been struggling the past couple of days. My IT guy's on it, but it's not, I guess it comes from GoDaddy. Also on the MariaSanchezShow.com as well as LATalkRadio.com and iTunes. So you can get, there's no excuse that you can't put us where you are on your handheld and to have you join us for a part of your day. Thank you so much for that honor. We have today, our medical correspondent is visiting with us. His name is Dr. Michael Applebaum. He's a medical doctor and an attorney. He's out of Chicago, Illinois. He's going to be speaking with us about Stop Nutritional Child Abuse. So we know what child abuse is, and he maintains that nutritional child abuse is rampant. And then we will be visiting with the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club. We like to promote nonprofits as often as possible and local ones whenever possible, because the Ventura County side of the community in Southern California gets ignored a lot. So, because if it's not in Los Angeles or Santa Barbara, if you're not from California, it's in between those two counties. And if there's not mud or blood, then it just misses the media. Shared with you at the end of yesterday's broadcast about my father, and I'll just give you an update because you've been so kind to reach out to me and my family with your thoughts and your prayers. This one's got us pretty shaken. It's interesting. My dad will be 84 next month. And he is the bionic man, as my mother says. She says, he's busily spending your inheritance. He's had one shoulder replaced, both knees replaced, both hips replaced. He's done implants with the teeth and whatever else needs to be done. He's been struggling with malignant melanoma for about 12 years now. It started in his head. They actually had to scalp him down to the bone on the head and then take skin from his lats on the back and put that, transplant that to the top of his head, and then take shaved skin from his thighs to replace the skin that they took from his back. He used to look like a conehead from Saturday Night Live, and now it's not a pretty sight, but he's alive and kicking. So that cancer went down to the shins. He had chemo and radiation last November, and that skin got burnt off, so he's been struggling dealing with getting that skin to heal. Did it happen? Yes, Tuesday. So 2 days ago, he was in the hyperbaric chamber, as he is every day for months on end, 2 hours at a time, Monday through Friday. And my brother, youngest, who lives in San Diego, told me this yesterday. He said, so instead of sitting down on a chair and putting his shorts on one leg at a time, as an almost 84-year-old man, he stood on one leg to get his other leg in through to the shorts, and it snagged and he fell. So spiral femur fracture and bleeding on the brain, that's been taken care of. He was supposed to be moved out of ICU yesterday, and that didn't happen. But in the meantime, the good news is the bleeding on the brain has subsided, and they gave him transfusion, and that helped. And tomorrow is scheduled the surgery to take the hip out, to put a rod in, to fuse the bones as best as possible, put a new hip in, and then he can deal with recovery. So, as I said, it's got this time around, it's got us all a little bit filled with trepidation. And, you know, he's been a warrior. by the way, my father was in the Air Force in the Korean War, and he's been a fighter his whole life. He actually was a Golden Glove boxer as well. He's quite the man. He's a self-made man. He was educated through high school. He went to a military academy. He was a sharpshooter and has made just a quite wonderful life for he and my mother and then raising the four of us. So it's been great. So that's tomorrow, so we'll keep you posted. It's if it isn't one thing, it's another is what it seems like. So Major League Baseball is in the news today because ESPN has made a report. Major League Baseball won't comment on it. They're saying that all they can say is that there is an investigating. They confirmed that an investigation is in the works. It has the potential to be the worst drug abuse case in the history of baseball. They say they're likely to suspend some 20 players. They may seek to double the possible suspension time for the players by counting the doping itself as one infraction and then lying about having taken the drugs as a second infraction, which means that they might be suspended for 100 games. They, according to the leaks, it's including New York Yankee A-Rod Rodriguez as well as Ryan Braun of the Milwaukee Brewers are among those suspected of facing suspension. And again, this hasn't been confirmed, but it's being reported wildly. Braun, you may remember, had a drug test in 2012 that showed high levels of testosterone in his body, but he successfully disputed the process of the testing, so his suspension was overturned in February of this year. It's involving a Miami anti-aging clinic called Biogenesis, and that was run by Anthony Bosch. So according to ESPN, Bosch, who allegedly supplied the players with the performing enhancing substances, which also has an acronym PEDS, or PEDS, Performance Enhancing Substances, has agreed to cooperate with the Major League Baseball investigation. And the league filed a lawsuit against Biogenesis in March for allegedly doing this, and they may drop their suit against Bosch if he cooperates. So you see there's something in it for him. And I always wonder about people who do wrongdoing, and I'm not perfect, and I will be the first to say that I have failed in many ways to spouses, to children, to friends, to family, but not overtly or not, I mean, not intentionally. And my ex used to say, you know, just because you didn't intend to hurt somebody doesn't mean you didn't hurt somebody. And I get that. But when you do something that is illegal, now, granted, A-Rod's the highest paid baseball player in the MLB. So it worked for him. And I get that, too. But I would think that someday, somehow, some way, it's going to be uncovered. And then you've lost it all, like Lance Armstrong. I mean, he had all that greatness and all of that adulation and all those records, and it's all gone. So I don't know if it's arrogance or if it's ego or narcissism that they think it's not going to happen to them. So, by the way, the science behind this, the tornadoes and the ranking and what they do and why there are people who actually study it because it's serious science and they are putting probes and sensors directly in the tornadoes path so they can detect things that you can't get from afar. Well, today it's coming out that the second tornado that hit the El Reno area, which was on Friday, May 31st, has been ranked an EF5. So it was hit by two EF5s, one on May 20th and now the one on Friday. And they're saying that it also created a record. It was 2.6 miles wide with winds that reached nearly 300 miles an hour. So the storm's 2.6 mile wide path surpassed the record that was set in 2004 in Nebraska. So what they said is because it was so wide, it did not look like a typical tornado. And the quote from the Weather Service is, a 2.5 mile wide tornado would not look like a tornado to a lot of people, explaining that the twister would not have a tapered funnel and would instead resemble a dark cloud hanging below the horizon. So not only was it 2.6 miles wide, it cut a swath of 16.2 miles in the destruction that it did. So the strongest winds ever measured on Earth were 302 miles per hour, and that dubious distinction also goes to Moore, Oklahoma, when that was hit by an EF5 in 1999. So the good news, if there is good news in any of this, is that the path that the tornado went through was a pretty desolate area. Otherwise, it would have been major, major destruction everywhere. So there are tornado watching groups, and not what they call the storm chasers who come from the feature film Twister. They're calling them Children of Twister, which is the 1996 film that spawned a generation of storm chasers who search it just for thrills with no idea of the risks. There are companies that do this for scientific reasons, and there are also companies that do tornado watching, but they don't go near. They go close, but they know their stuff and they pull out. So we will get into more news of the day after we have our conversation with Dr. Michael Applebaum, who we are calling right now.
Speaking.
Dr. Michael Applebaum, welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. You're live. Thank you for joining us and making the time to visit with us. We appreciate it.
It is my pleasure to speak with you and your audience. How are you?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Doing better than the Blackhawks.
Okay. All right. Now, let's get right into it. Because child abuse, we know what it's commonly referred to. And we've had a story here in Southern California that's been horrific involving an 8-year-old that ended up getting killed by the mother's boyfriend, and including BB gun shots in his face and his groin, two knocked out teeth and broken ribs, and he was killed. So we know that is child abuse. You have a different form of child abuse that you're referring to.
Well, actually, I'm an advocate for fitness. I'm an advocate for children. And I also advocate against nutritional child abuse. And it's not something esoteric that I created. If you look at the California statutes and the statutes in many states that define what child abuse is, clearly nutritional child abuse, which is overfeeding a kid to the point of making him or her sick or imminently sick, is a form of child abuse. So, for example, according to your statutes, again, California, severe physical abuse means the willful, prolonged failure to provide adequate food. Adequate food is enough. Adequate food is not too little. Adequate food is not too much. Adequate food is enough. And if you look at the neglect definition, it's the willful or negligent failure of the parent or guardian to provide the child with adequate food or to adequately supervise or protect the child. Clearly, feeding a child to the point of illness or imminent illness is an inadequate way of feeding them.
Now,
so this is not something made up. These are your statutes, not mine. And the question is, do these legislators and those who are charged with enforcing the law actually mean what they do and say?
But when you say feed a child, as a parent, the only time I was feeding my child was when they were infants and could not put the food into their own mouths themselves.
No, neglect has to do with the failure or inability of the parent or guardian to adequately supervise or protect the child. So if you're not supervising your child well enough so that that child is eating itself into illness, or it is not being sufficiently protected from doing that, that, according to California law, is child neglect. Period. End.
And has it ever been enforced in the methodology?
Oh, sure.
That you're
oh, yeah.
Of?
No, there are states that do that, and clearly, you know, it is not done regularly or routinely, which is why it makes the news. But Pennsylvania, Texas, other states have actually removed children from homes where these children were at risk, severe risk. So they let them get so sick that they became severely sick and therefore at risk of death. And they removed them from the home and did whatever they felt they needed to do in order to protect the child.
And when you say
sick...
But
that's bad, that's too late.
You're saying, when you say sick, you're saying obese.
No, no. Obesity and overweight are not sicknesses. Obesity and overweight are conditions. You get sick like you get apnea, which means you can't breathe. You get sick like you get diabetes, which is lack of blood sugar control. Those are the sicknesses. Overweight and obesity, nobody seems to care about enough, so they wait until somebody gets so sick that then they take them out.
Now, but those are internal, so somebody from afar wouldn't know that somebody is a diabetic or wouldn't know that they have apnea.
Well, that is true, but that is not the point. The point is that the neglect or the abuse is visible because these kids are big and fat, and therefore they are at risk of severe physical harm. And if you look at even the definition of emotional abuse, you'll see that that would fall under letting kids get so fat that they become victims of emotional abuse.
From others.
So, yes, of course.
Right.
So the point being that the laws are there to protect the children. Nobody enforces the laws in order to protect the children. And by the time somebody gets around to doing something in order to help the children, the process is so far along that it becomes a very severe, almost emergent form of rescue, where we can intervene earlier.
So how would parent do what you suggest? How would they structure their child's consumption? And when we say child, we're speaking minor children, anybody under 18, especially when you have high school, let's say, students who are gone a lot for the day. They can't be supervising them.
Well, you know, it's like anything else where you have a balance sheet. If you're aware of the fact, because your kid is fat, that he or she may be eating too much while they're out of the house, then when they're at the house, you feed them fewer calories.
Now,
no mystery over here.
Well, as you know, I have four children, and one of them was obese. And obviously it pained me to see him emotionally eat. But in front of me, he never consumed in gross quantities that I would have said, you know, like, stop. Also,
It's not a matter of in front of you how much he or she has, and I don't want to make it personal.
To make it personal, because this is personal, but it's also a universal message, and I appreciate the topic, and that's why I wanted to have the conversation with you. But as a parent who, quote, failed because I wasn't able to keep my child from being obese, I'm particularly sensitive to it, as you can well understand, but I'm curious how you think that I could have prevented it.
The point being that it's a balance sheet. If the kid is eating too much out of the house, the kid gets fed fewer calories in the house. If somebody cannot deal with it for whatever the reason, there are mechanisms in place through child welfare services or whatever it's called in California, child and family services here in Chicago in the Illinois area, in order to get assistance, but you have to avail yourself of that. There are ways to do it because there are mechanisms in place. You need to recognize that there's a problem. You need to admit that it's a problem that is beyond your ability to control. You need to then seek the assistance that's available for which we are all paying. And if it's not going to be made available to you for whatever reason, then somebody has to challenge the system. There's a second line of defense that is actually a huge embarrassment. And that second line of defense are the mandatory reporters by statute who are supposed to let the authorities know when a child is being neglected or abused. That includes teachers, principals, school administrators, nurses, physicians, others, everybody except politicians. And if those individuals who are mandated by law are not reporting to the proper authorities that a child is being nutritionally abused, then that person, he or she, is a lawbreaker in virtually every state in the union. They are not doing their mandated jobs. So every time you read a news article about some teacher or physician complaining about how fat his or her patients or school children are and aren't doing anything to report them to the proper authorities in the state of California, that individual is breaking the law.
But again, you're saying that they would have to do that because they see somebody as fat or obese, not because
that
they know
correct.
That they have diabetes or sleep
Absolutely,
apnea.
Because those children who are fat or obese or overweight are at risk. Clearly, they are demonstrating the signs of a failure or inability of that child's parent or guardian to adequately supervise or protect that child. Clearly. You have that manifestation.
And in theory, I understand and I appreciate what you're saying here, because you're right. If somebody is obese and that is problematic either now or down the line, then something needs to be done. And if the family isn't doing it, then the authorities need to be notified because they're not fulfilling their job. But having had an obese child, There's nothing that I didn't try. I had hired a nutritionist who visited with him once a week, enrolled him in Weight Watchers. He wouldn't go to the meeting, so we did it online. I took him to a doctor who did one of those protein sparing things where you just have, you know, pure protein in a shake. That didn't work. Did Cortislim? You name it. I offered the options, and my other children weren't. So obviously, it wasn't what he was getting at home. It was what he was doing outside
well,
my
you know, and again, I'm sorry. I'm going to move off that because that is a piece of anecdotal information. That is an individual's experience, and I'm not going to extrapolate from that to the rest of the entirety of the population. I think what we need to do is focus on those measures that government, which more people rely on than probably ought to, that government has put in place in order to protect children. And that information should be made available to parents so they can avail themselves of those services. And if the state is unwilling to provide the services that it has passed laws and regulations to do, then at least they ought to man up and say, you know what? We just did this frivolously. We really don't care about our children. We really aren't going to fund these programs. We really aren't going to follow through on these things and find a different strategy. But there's something in place, and that should be taken advantage of.
And what's in place other than the fact that people should be reporting obese children to the authorities?
Well, because once you report these things to the appropriate authorities, then there is supposed to be a mechanism for rescuing the children from that problem. What that entails is going to, I assume, be individualized from state to state, that mechanism. But that is in place.
So it seems to me that what you're asking of the authorities is that then even more of a nanny state.
No, absolutely not. The nanny state is there. This is already statist. I'm saying put up or shut up.
Okay, so you're saying...
I'm saying if you're putting these laws in place, then enforce them. If you're not going to enforce them, then just admit it, move on, and acknowledge that you just either don't care or you're doing something for the expediency of your political careers, but you weren't doing in order to help anybody.
And by programs in place, do you mean healthy eating programs and getting people to exercise, or you mean...
Well, that's actually a separate issue. But I will say that the program in place generally is visitation by those social workers or individuals in the department who are supposed to come up with some sort of solution in order to assist the child. Remember, the reason that we have child abuse laws is to protect children from their parents and guardians. That's why they are there.
Mm-hmm.
And really, this whole thing came about, as you know, because of an article that came out last week about just how devastatingly damaging type 2 diabetes is to children relative to adults. Because when adults give themselves type 2 diabetes, apparently the ill effects of it don't progress as quickly as they do with children. So they had this study where they took just shy of 700, 699 kids aged 10 to 17. I don't know why they couldn't find the 700. But anyway, they took 699 of these kids. They put them through what would be considered the Cadillac, or maybe a Lexus or a Mercedes, whatever people drive that's high-end, program where they gave them medications for free, where they gave them transportation to and from the clinic for free, where they had parents involved in the lifestyle interventions and the clinic visits, and these kids still deteriorated physically, in terms of the functioning of their pancreas, which is involved in diabetes, and their kidneys, which is ill affected by diabetes, they still progressed at a very fast rate downward, despite the fact that they had all these things. And it made no difference what the intervention was. They divided this group of 699 kids into three different groups, that one of them getting one medication, another one getting two medications, and the third group getting one medication and a lifestyle intervention program, and nothing seemed to help. They developed high blood pressure. They developed kidney disease. So we're dealing here with a real problem. It's not going to get better as they get older.
you're making me wonder about my son's what's going on inside of him, because maybe by the grace of God he escaped that. But because he's
my guess, you know, they do the test over at the physician's office. They find out whether he got lucky or didn't. That, mm-hmm. You know, that's something they can find out.
Mm-hmm.
But the point being that people are having kids and then going through the process of harming them. And the point being that there are mechanisms in place that should be there in order to prevent that, and nobody, the adults are just not stepping up to the plate. Not the mandatory reporters, not the parents, not the politicians, not those people who are charged with protecting children.
And I would imagine, it seems in general, and correct me if I'm wrong, that fat people have fat children.
Fat people, of course, have fat children. That's correct. If you have one fat parent, then your likelihood is greater than 60% that you're going to have a fat kid. And if you have two fat parents, it's almost 100%. That's so, because parents, adults, don't know how to exert caloric intake control, so they pass the same problem on to their kids. Fat is a choice. And these people are making terrible choices for their children.
But then you would have to suggest that they're addled, so how are they to provide, be a good role model? Obviously they're not, and or to provide...
They can't, of course not.
Right.
That's why you have to have outside intervention or to assist these individuals in raising kids who aren't going to be sick because of the same sins of the parents.
And, you know, I try to get some kind of solution to this. What is the solution, do you think?
Well, the solution has nothing to do with what's in place. The solution is making people economically responsible for the harm that they're causing to the rest of society. I mean, if you had a reflection of these types of problems in people's insurance rates, then you would actually have a solution to the problem. Because people understand when they can't pay for their cable TV. They don't understand when they kill their kids. It's a very peculiar situation.
And any good news to this, Michael?
There is no good news to this one. This is a bad thing. It's like saying any good news to cancer. You know, there is no good news on this one. The only thing that is of value on the good side, which I won't say is news, is that because it's a choice to be fat, it is also a choice to become unfat.
Mm-hmm.
So it is possible. But there is no good news on this one. How can there be any good news on kids being abused or neglected? It's a toughie.
But I have heard, and is it the exception, that folks who have taken care of their health, that they actually can get off their diabetes, the insulin, and or lessen it because their body is starting to respond to the...
Absolutely. So if you happen to be insulin-dependent or insulin-resistant because you're fat and you become not fat, then you actually, with a very, very high percentage, nothing's 100%, but with a very high percentage, you actually... lose your insulin resistance, or you need to take insulin.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So there's the good news.
Okay.
Come on, help me with my Pollyanna, please.
You know, you found that I couldn't. Your vision on this stuff is better than mine.
And briefly, before you go, speak with our listeners about your philosophy about childbearing and the mother in terms of her fitness and health.
It's my humble opinion, and actually it has been followed, and not that they're following me because... whatever, but Massachusetts General Hospital, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, the European Society of Human Reproduction and Embryology, all of these different societies recommend, as I've been calling for decades, that before people get pregnant, they normalize their weight, because fat parents have fat kids, and fat parents, fat mothers in particular, have complications of pregnancy that aren't seen by humans of intended weight size. And that puts their kids, their children to be at risk. Miscarriage rates are up. Tough delivery rates are up. Time spent in the neonatal ICU are up. Dollars and cents up. All these things are more expensive and more costly on a human level. So before you go and get pregnant, which is usually a choice for most people, before you go and get pregnant, normalize your weight and give your kid a fighting chance of having a healthy life.
So that's how forgiving the body is that if you've been abusing it, if you will, by being overweight and however that manifests itself, if you get in shape or get fit or get reduce the weight, then that doesn't carry forward to the pregnancy when you conceive thereafter.
That is correct. It is an avoidable complication. And I think I started the very first program called, I called it Fit to Parent, and also over a decade ago, in order to assist people in trying to have healthy pregnancies. This is one of those things where actually you can make a big difference, mm-hmm. not only in your life, but in the life of your child.
Mm-hmm. That's so there, more good news, Michael. See, in spite of yourself.
In spite of me, the good news just keeps coming out. What can I say?
And give your website that you prefer.
Fitnessmed.com, anabolicclinic.com.
Excellent. Michael, thank you for your time. Really appreciate
and
it, as
thank
always.
You. You're best to you and your audience.
Thank you, thank you. Dr. Michael Applebaum, he never, ever, ever disappoints with what he has. And as a mother, as I said, with an obese child, and I don't want to bring it down to me, but I'm not the only one that have obese children. I did everything I could short of being the food police. And I just had this conversation with my sons last week. They come for dinner every Wednesday. So, yes, tonight I get to celebrate them. And I'm cooking. They've been cooking every other week. That's just started in the last month. But I said to my son, I said, I didn't want to be the food police. And he said, I wish you would have. And I said, so what, I'm going to slap your hand? I'm going to take it away from you? To me, I went to college with a gal whose parents did that. And she said that that made her go under her bed and eat, or go into her closet and eat before or after the family meals. And the thought of that girl doing that just broke my heart. And it obviously stuck with me forever, because I thought, I didn't want my son hiding, or to feel guilty, or to wondering if I'm looking at every time he's putting something in his mouth. That wasn't a job I wanted. But I did try to support him in other ways. And you know what? None of it worked. And guess what? What worked? When he decided that he was done being fat and he wanted to take care of it, and he did, and he lost 175 pounds, and he did it through diet and exercise. He didn't do any gadgets or lap band or gastric, or which you should... Dr. Michael has a whole host of opinions about those sorts of procedures. So in the desire to get some good news to you, we have a new study offered by researchers at the University of Chicago and reviewed by a team at Harvard University talking about marriages. And here we go. This is a statement of the time. 35% of the marriages, and they covered 19,000 people, marriages that occurred between the years of 2005 and 2012, 35% of those marriages occurred between couples who found one another through the internet. So they half of those who met online did so through dating sites, so specifically dating. And we're going to have an interview later in the week with this online dating community that has events that are niche events. So, in other words, like, if they have a speed dating thing. Have you ever done a speed dating where you, like, the men sit and the women go around and they ring a bell and you get up and you move to the next man and get up and move to the next man? I actually did one because I interviewed a gal who had one, and she invited me at the last minute because she had a cancellation and she needed another woman. And she says, and I was single, of course, she said, would you mind? And I was like, no, that's okay, because it made the dynamics better, because then there wasn't a man who was sitting alone for a session waiting for the next gal to move around. It was interesting, and you actually got, you know, 5 minutes is quick, but you had face-to-face contact. You could see what they looked like and how they spoke and how they were groomed and et cetera. So that dating company, with the niche ones, they'll have, like, they'll exploit fetishes, for example. And it was in the news yesterday, which is why we contacted them, because they have one coming up that is the men. It's called Hung, H-U-N-G, and the men have to be 7 inches or longer. And they don't measure them, but they said that if a woman finds out later that that's not the case, then she's supposed to report them to her, and then they'll be dropped, et cetera. So there's accountability. Anyway, so 35% of marriages occur between couples who found one another through the internet, half on dating sites. The other half, 20%, met through social networking sites, including Twitter and Facebook. 15% met through online mediums such as email and chat rooms. The study also found that those who met online were less likely to get divorced. So the author of the study, the lead author, says these data suggest that the internet may be altering the dynamics and outcomes of marriage itself. Researchers reportedly found that the majority of new spouses still meet through offline means, obviously, if it's 35% that meet online, including 21% who met at work, 19% who met through mutual friends, and the 10% who met at school. So it used to be that people would scorn it, and now if everyone's, including my 20-something-year-old kids, they're on the internet too. So there you have it. Today, earlier, the Connecticut General Assembly is preventing the public release of homicide victims' photos, videos, and some audio tapes, and this is in response to the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting rampage. They're establishing a new exemption under the state's Freedom of Information Act, and the governor is expected to sign the bill. Once he signs the measure, it takes effect immediately. The bill prohibits the release of photographs, film, video, and other visual images showing a homicide victim if the records could reasonably be expected to constitute an unwarranted invasion of personal privacy of the victim or the victim's surviving family members. However, parts of 911 call tapes will be made public, according to the bill. So, guess who opposed this? And they wrote a letter, and they said, why? Because, and I'll give you that quote, but the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, the Connecticut Daily Newspapers Association, the Connecticut Broadcasters Association, and the Connecticut Council on Freedom of Information. They said the documents are essential to public watchdogs keeping an eye on government. I disagree. Seeing a dead child has, what is that? I think we need to have some decorum. We need to have some decency. And because of that, I don't watch things that go viral that are because of the hellaciousness of it or the grossness of it or whatever. I do not wish to participate in that accident staring. I also don't do it every morning when I'm driving in to the studios. If there's something going on, I refuse to look at it. I will not be a looky-loo. No. And yes, I'm one person, and I believe that we all make a difference. So Susan G. Komen announced yesterday that they are canceling fundraising walks next year in 7 cities where the money goals haven't been met. The organization said that they are canceling the 3-day walks in Phoenix, Boston, Chicago, Cleveland, Tampa Bay, San Francisco, and Washington. The event will continue to take place in 7 other cities that have already been participating. That's Atlanta, Dallas-Fort Worth, Michigan, Philadelphia, San Diego, Seattle, and Minneapolis-St. Paul. Now, they say that part of the problem is that when they were trying not to fund Planned Parenthood, there was such an outcry that they had to go ahead and fund it. Now, them funding Planned Parenthood was to provide access to breast cancer screening, but because they couldn't dictate what Planned Parenthood did with the money, it ended up unsuspectingly or unintendedly also going into family planning things that Planned Parenthood provides. So they're saying that in participation in the 3-day walks declined by 37% in the past 4 years. And they announced this on their Facebook page. Everything is coming through these other mediums. The difficult decision to exit these markets was not made lightly. As we know, this bold and empowering event has touched the lives of thousands of participants like you. So Nancy Brinker, who is the group's founder, she founded the organization in 1982, 2 years after her sister, Susan G. Komen, died of breast cancer. So I'm not sure if you knew that or not. But after the controversy about the Planned Parenthood, several leaders stepped down, including the founder. She stepped down as CEO, although she continues to hold a management role. And we've had the pleasure and the honor of interviewing her in the past to help promote their walks when we've had our program in other communities. And then finally, this went viral, so it was under the radar last week when the yearbooks were issued, and then one girlfriend of the couple that was voted as the cutest couple in the senior class posted their picture on her Tumblr account, and she said, first time in my school history a same-sex couple has even been able to run for this category, not to mention winning it. So proud of them and my school. The school is Carmel, New York, Heist, and it's the high school seniors, Dylan Meehan and Bradley Taylor. They won cutest couple. And it used to be, this school is 65 miles north of New York City, that at first you could only pick a boy and a girl to be cutest couple. But a bunch of students said, no, we want to pick student one and student two. And they did that. And so they picked this gay couple. And the father of one of the boys says, I feel like both of our families... No, this is the father's quote. Oh, I think of it as any other normal day. He won. Okay, lots of people win cutest couple. Back in the day, it was different, races being together. So for me, it shouldn't be anything. He's very excited that he won, and I'm surprised that it's a big deal. And it's like, okay, so we are actually advancing socially, believe it or not. Supreme Court's supposed to rule. So our next speaker is the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club, and we're going to be speaking with him this morning about the Greater Oxnard Port Hueneme Boys and Girls Club.
It's a great day at the Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Oxnard and Port Hueneme.
There you go.
If you know your party's extension, please dial it now. Yes, if not, please stay on the line for a directory of our staff.
See, raw radio.
Please hold while I try that extension.
Tim Baylock is his name.
Hi, this is Tim.
Hi, Tim. Good morning. Maria Sanchez, you're live on the air. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Let us know about the Boys and Girls Club and then specifically about the Greater Oxnard Port Hueneme Boys and Girls Club that you're directly responsible for.
Well, Boys and Girls Clubs are in 4,000 communities across America, serving about 4 million youth. And we serve kids 6 to 18 years of age. In a variety of different ways, academic success, healthy lifestyles, and a variety of educational programs is what we strive to provide to our youth. In the past, Boys and Girls Clubs have typically been more around recreation and after-school programs, and we've extended our program here locally in Oxnard and Port Hueneme into job training and a lot of teen programs as well.
And what made the shift, and when?
Well, we've always served teens, 6 to 18, our youth 6 to 18. But the shift has come in the last few years where the economy has driven us, and also the high dropout rate in the high schools has encouraged us to support our schools and be able to provide extra services to get, our youth prepared for the workforce.
And how do you go about that? I assume this is always after school, your programs?
Yeah. We work in a variety of ways. We have entrepreneurial programs. We work with the high schools. And we're opening up a teen center. Well, we've opened it already, but the grand opening is June 27th. And the public is welcome to come by at 4 p.m. To help us celebrate that. And youth are welcome from 5 until 10 p.m. that day. There's a lot of activities going on. And if they don't know anything about Boys and Girls Clubs, they'll be able to find out a lot about us at that event.
And what does the teen center mean? Is it a separate building? It's structured?
Yeah, it's a separate building. It's on it's the historic Boys and Girls Club. We call it the Harriet H. Samuelson Boys and Girls Club. And the teen center itself will be called the Club Teen Center. And we're trying to get away from the little kid stigma with Boys and Girls Clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And teens like the club the better. So that's what we're naming it, and our signage will reflect that. And that building is located at 126 East 7th Street in Oxnard. And it has a gymnasium, technology and arts and crafts, and a college and career center. We even have a charter school that we partner with. It's called Vista Riel Charter School. And they have space in our building as well.
And how did you get to the point where you could open the teen center? I would imagine that took a lot of fundraising.
Yeah, we have a lot of partners. We have a lot of, it takes a lot of money to provide for teens. And we only charge $20 a year for membership. And so we have to do a lot of fundraising. and our board of directors. We have 30 board of directors, and they decided, hey, this is a priority for our organization that we want to do more for this age group.
And will it supplant services that you had been doing, or it's going to enhance services that you have been providing?
Basically what it's doing is it's consolidating all of our teen programs into one area. We'll still have teen programs at our Port Hueneme branch as well because it's farther away. But our Fifth Street Club will only serve 6 to 12-year-olds, and the space that used to be just for teens will now be turned into a preschool because early education is very, very important, as you know, and we're trying to do more in that area as well. So hopefully sometime this year we'll open up a preschool.
So it's almost like cradle to college.
Absolutely, and that's what we're trying to do is to try to, basically diplomas to degrees has been our thing for teens, but really it's almost diapers to degrees is what we're trying to do. And we support a lot of kids after they're 18 years of age as well. We have many kids that are going to college. Our graduation rate here at the Boys and Girls Club is 96%.
Really?
Our kids, yes. And, in the city of Oxnard, our schools are about 70%. So we know if we get to see these kids 3 days a week or more, we can make a difference in their lives.
And is it open to anybody?
It's open to anybody, yes.
So you don't restrict in terms of attendance or participation via numbers?
No, not at all.
Wow.
It's open, and, during the summer months, we're open from 7 a.m. in the morning until 6 p.m. The teen center's open until 8 p.m., but we have a lot of different programs going on for kids during the summer, and as you know, summer brain drain is a big deal, and so what we try to do is, it's not school, but it's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of education and learning happening here every day.
Do you charge for summer different than for the school year?
We have summer day camps that, parents can drop their kids off at 7. They can stay all the way until 6, and there is a fee for, the week-long program. It's like $85 for the whole week, and that includes a free lunch. But any kid can drop in from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock, and there's, it's just the membership fee of $20, and they still get the free lunch as well.
Now, how do you keep track of if kids drop in, if they're coming and going?
Well, we say drop in, but we keep track. Every kid is signed in and signed out, and we keep track of who's in the day camp programs, and we keep them separate. And the day camp programs come along with field trips and different activities, and we have an adult to youth ratio of 1 to 20. So it's a different format, and we just keep them separate. And the day camp gets over at 2 p.m., and then those kids are just they turn into drop-in kids until their parents pick them up at 6 p.m.
So having had 4 children and always wondering what I was going to do with them over summer, your prices sound, because my kids are in their 20s now, unbelievably reasonable for what you're offering.
Yeah, no, we're not in the business to make money. We're a nonprofit 501c3. We're here to serve kids. We do have to pay our bills, but we try to keep it as affordable as possible for all youth. And no child is ever turned away from our programs due to economic hardship. We will scholarship them. We'll do whatever we can to help the families.
And how do you make your bills work with charging that? It must be a lot of donations, grants, fundraisers.
Yeah, we do a lot of fundraising during the year. Right now we're doing our annual campaign where we're asking individuals in the community and businesses to, help support us. And we do three major events a year. We do an auction. We're doing a casino night this year. And then we do an annual breakfast where we bring in a keynote speaker, and then we make an ask on the community. And we, of course, get foundation grants and some government grants as well, and that's how we support ourselves.
And website, please, for contact?
Our website is www.bgcop.org.
And when we post this, we'll post your contact information as well.
All right. Thank you very
much. Tim, thank you so much for your time. Tim Balock, CEO of the Boys and Girls Club, that's Greater Oxnard in Port Hueneme. If you have a charity, a 501c, a nonprofit that you'd like to help us promote or highlight, we are amenable to that. We're all about helping the world be a better place. This is Maria Sanchez. Thank you so much for listening. I look forward to visiting you tomorrow. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you for listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com. Live every weekday morning, 9 a.m. Pacific, and on the net at LATalkRadio.com and MariaSanchezShow.com.